This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with David Gespass from the National Lawyers Guild about a delegation to Pakistan and a preliminary report on the delegation findings.
The last few years have not been kind to the people of Pakistan. Never close to a democracy, it's even farther away today.
We'll also hear a speech by Roberto Lovato given at the Brecht Forum event, Bricks in the Wall, How a U.S. Police State is Being Built. We'll also hear an encore Law and Disorder interview with human rights lawyer Maureen Webb, author of Illusions of Security, Global Surveillance and Democracy in the Post-9/11 World. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, Director of the USA Program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
A recent delegation to Pakistan from the National Lawyers Guild has just issued a preliminary report on its findings regarding the impacts of the proclamation of the emergency in Pakistan. The report finds that anything short of restoring the judges deposed on November 2007 will have long-lasting negative impacts on the judiciary and the rule of law in Pakistan. The delegation also notes structural problems in the pre-election climate, such as lack of an independent judiciary, that would make free and fair elections nearly impossible. The delegation's findings are based on over 50 interviews with political party leaders, lawyers, members of civil society, government officials, judges, students, and journalists in Lahore, Karachi, Peshawar, Quetta, and Islamabad. Joining us today to talk about the Pakistani delegation is David Gespass, Vice President of the National Lawyers Guild. David, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
We understand you've just returned from a delegation to Pakistan. Why did you go?
The recent events in Pakistan obviously were of particular interest to lawyers and of particular concern to people who are interested in the independence of the judiciary, rule of law, and the legal system in general. Beyond that, we felt a responsibility as American citizens because the role of the United States government in its foreign policy is so critical to support for the Musharraf government.
We were with the Lawyers Guild delegation marching in front of the Pakistani embassy a couple of weeks ago. I was out there with Heidi. They got rid of all the judges. They put lawyers in prison. It was really unparalleled. We had the American Bar Association, you know, these Republicans from white shoe firms out there demonstrating. Did you get a shot in the arm from that kind of manifestation here in the United States?
That was certainly something that helped precipitate the interest. But seems to me that part of it is not just demonstrating here. Part of it is really the need to explore what is going on there. That was something that we were very fortunate to be able to do. I think it's something that the Lawyers Guild particularly was able to do. And, in fact, we were invited by Lahore University of Management Sciences Rule of Law Project.
Well, if you had to sum it up in a nutshell about what did you find, what can you teach us?
We came up with four basic findings. One is, unless the judges who were deposed on November 3rd by Musharraf are reinstated, the future for an independent judiciary and the rule of law in Pakistan is bleak. Secondly, there is a serious attack on freedom of the press there that really needs to be countervailed as well. Both of those things make the upcoming parliamentary elections suspect in terms of whether they can meet international standards for being free and fair. And finally, and this is the one that I think is key to what we did and what we were looking at, first, there's a premise, and the premise is that the real struggle in the world today is not between democracy and so-called terrorism, but it's really between advancing the institutions that promote democratic rule of law and human rights on the one hand, and repressing those things on the other hand. It's clear from the over 50 interviews that we conducted and all our investigation that U.S. policy supports the latter rather than the former.
The latter being the suppression of democratic institutions.
Right.
Yeah, are you saying that you think the U.S. tacitly approved of putting all those judges out to pasture and arresting all those lawyers?
The U.S. did not oppose it. Whether they approved of it privately or not is really of no great moment. Because they do support Musharraf. And essentially, the position the United States government takes is that because Musharraf is a supposed ally in the so-called war on terror, we have to accept certain things that we may not like about the way he's running the country.
David, you know, I have a question about this, because I know your 4 points. I think they're really excellent, and I really am enthusiastic about the trip and the report, which we'll tell people how to get. But in some senses, why was there this break all of a sudden? I mean, as you said, Musharraf has essentially been, you know, running that country with U.S. support as almost a dictatorship for a number of years. And all of a sudden, of course, the judges and the lawyers are going to jail, and it's getting a little more dramatic. But essentially, the country has been, you would hesitate to ever call it a democracy. So what really shifted at this moment that made you guys go, that made us all more concerned by it?
Pakistan has an interesting history, actually. It's sort of gone back and forth between making steps towards democracy and then military coups. In fact, Musharraf came to power in a military coup that, by and large, people over there seem not to mind because the prior elected government was deemed to be so corrupt. But what's happened recently is there had been a real move on the part of the judiciary towards some independence, and there were a number of specific cases that raised that issue. There was a steel mill case that involved the government selling to private investors, many of whom were connected to the military or were army generals, some steel mills at extraordinarily discounted rates, in which the value of the land was worth more than what they paid for it, not to mention the steel mills on it. And the Supreme Court found that it was a violation of the law to do that because of the lack of clarity.
Where are those judges now?
They are either deposed, and a couple of them are still under house arrest. Chief Justice Chaudhry remains under house arrest at this time. We weren't able to talk to him. The government would not respond.
That's a good point you're making. You know, a couple of years ago, you know, we represent some people who have been disappeared in Pakistan at various times. In fact, Mozam Beg, who's now living in England, was sent to Guantanamo from Pakistan. But before that happened, his father filed a writ of habeas corpus in Pakistan, probably 2002 sometime. And actually, the court took it seriously and ordered the Pakistani government to bring Mozam Beg before them. But of course, the order was ignored, and they then gave him to the U.S., who sent him out. So you're right. I mean, I think that there was this sort of at least a little bit of tension in the country around the judiciary being somewhat independent on those kinds of
things.
There
really wasn't. There was a number of cases involving disappeared persons, some of which the court actually took up on its own motion, and others of which were brought by the Pakistan Human Rights Commission. And the court insisted that the right of habeas corpus should exist in Pakistan, something that's under attack here in the United States as well. When, in fact, the first time Musharraf tried to get rid of the Chief Justice, the court, by a 10-3 vote, reinstated him, and that was following the mass demonstrations that took place among the members of the bar in Pakistan. And those are the things we think that really prompted the crackdown in November.
We've been speaking with attorney David Gespass, who is a leader of the National Lawyers Guild and who was over in Pakistan investigating the arrests and imprisonment of judges and lawyers on a mass scale over there. David, your delegation came back jet-lagged as they were, and issued an excellent report. We're going to put that connection up on our website.
You know, David, before you went, I was a little concerned for the delegation members' safety because of the recent assassination of Bhutto.
Minchin, what effect you think that assassination had?
Well, the assassination sort of ironically may lead to the results of the election being more reliable than they otherwise might have been. Not that they would be free and fair and transparent, but Musharraf government now is so utterly discredited and without support that it's going to be very difficult to skew the election sufficiently to really change the results very much. Beyond that, it remains to be seen. We do not expect that the elections will be free and fair. The climate in Pakistan was interesting. It was quite normal, and once we got there, there was really, despite a number of warnings even on the flight over, we really had no problems. At the same time, the day after we left Lahore to go to Islamabad, there was a bombing outside the High Court, and 23 police officers were killed.
Hadn't someone from the delegation been in the High Court the day before?
For the previous 3 days, he had been meeting with lawyers in and around the High Court. And in fact, he was saying, boy, I had so much more to do. I shouldn't have gone to Islamabad while we were on the bus.
Hmm.
But it's kind of random. You know, who expected the World Trade Center to be bombed twice?
I don't know, but I got a couple of people you could ask.
So overall, the conditions there outside of the border areas where we didn't go are really quite common, but problems with attacks have been spreading outside of the border areas to other parts of the country. Frankly, we think it is a consequence that the government is becoming more repressive rather than expanding democracy and human rights, which we believe is the way to prevent recruitment of violent elements and the way to ensure that society functions and people feel invested in it without having to resort to violence.
David, I understand copies of the report are available on the National Lawyers Guild website.
That's correct, under the International Committee on the National Lawyers Guild. And
that's nlg.org. Follow-up plans for the delegation?
Right now are actively talking to members of Congress. And we, in fact, got a very interesting letter from several senators calling for the reinstatement of the deposed judges. That is our immediate goal, is to do that work as well as talk to as many people in the public as possible about our findings. We also are going to be working on a final report once we go through some more data and review more documents, and that should be coming out in the next few months.
Wonderful. David, we're very proud of the work the delegation did, and thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder today.
Oh, well, I was just privileged to be working with the people on that delegation. They were amazing.
Great.
Well, you were the intrepid leader, so thank you.
Thanks, David.
Bye.
We go now to listen to Roberto Lovato's speech at the Brecht Forum. The event was titled Bricks in the Wall, How a U.S. Police State is Being Built. Roberto Lovato, a frequent Nation contributor, is a New York-based writer with New American Media. The event examined the near completion since 9/11 of the infrastructure for a police state in the United States, including its legal and ideological apparatus. Law and Disorder co-host Michael Stephen Smith and Vince Warren, executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, were also among the speakers. Let's have a listen.
Roberto Lovato.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm not sure exactly what a state is these days. It's a hard thing to define. And I'm not even sure exactly what a police is at this point. Take, for example, police in Georgia or another state that's passed a law that forces these police people to enforce federal law, immigration law. And then if you look at the degree of weaponry, the kind of weaponry being deployed by police by immigration agents. You have a serious military organization. I mean, that's what SWAT was all about in Los Angeles, and that's what it brought us. And so I don't have an answer to even exactly what is a state and what is a police, just up front, okay? So I want to talk to you about national security and the birth of the immigrant, of the anti-immigrant state. Mm-hmm. But then I thought, but why not talk about immigrants and the birth of the national security state? Because they are integrally, intimately connected. If you look at history, like I've been doing of late, because sometimes the present's not that happy a thing to look at, unless you look to Latin America, then it's really sunny and beautiful politically. So that said, let me first talk a little bit about a little story that I bring to you from Georgia, and then I want to go a little bit into my thesis, how the immigration debate, for example, is not primarily about immigrants, but in fact, it's primarily about the state. And then I want to go into history to illustrate kind of this thesis I'm trying to work on that I would love to engage people in after we. So when I hear Clark and Michael describe, you know, kind of the mechanics and, you know, geopolitical nefariousness of what our state is doing, I think about a young girl I know named Justine Mancha. She's a 14-year-old Mexican, a girl of Mexican descent, freckle-faced, wiry, and fiery, who was in late September last year coming out of the shower half-naked when suddenly she heard these cars pull up to her trailer. You know, she's a farm worker in rural Georgia. You know, in land that's been tilled by different classes of people, including slaves, for centuries, right? So this young girl came out of the shower to be greeted by heavily armed agents breaking down the door of her trailer, shoving, you know, guns in her face and asking her, "Where are the illegals? Where's your mother? Where are your papers?" And she says, "Oh my God," I yelled. My heart dropped. They kept asking me questions like, "Where's your mother? Where are the illegals?" And outside, her trailer home was surrounded by about 20 immigration and citizenship enforcement, or ICE agents, who were making sure that there was a private space to interrogate her. This young girl, who is quite outspoken, by the way, I had some slides of her speaking out. There's several plaintiffs who are now suing ICE in Georgia for these kinds of actions, which have increased exponentially in the past year since the big marches. Coincidence, right? As I'm talking to Justine, she's twitching. Her body twitches. She describes nightmares of being chased by men in uniform. She gets nervous around people with uniforms. Me being of Salvadoran extraction, born here, but having some experience with that, you know, tiny, inspired, but sometimes often very troubled country, it reminded me of young people and older people that I saw there, because that's what they call post-traumatic stress disorder. And oftentimes, what I learned in El Salvador, for example, was that the state was in the business of manufacturing post-traumatic stress and maintaining psychological operations 24/7. When I think about state, the brick and mortars of the state repression, I just don't think about immigrants or young. By the way, she's a citizen. She was a citizen, this young woman. I think about the way that the repressive apparatus is being constructed. It's not the same state anymore, right? They've hollowed out the inner workings of the state. Like, look at the welfare state. It's gone. I think about how these kinds of allegedly immigration-focused actions are really not just about the immigrants, but about the state's need to do several things. And among those things is obviously to control a low-wage workforce, right? A workforce that harmonizes wages. That, in other words, if you've got a cheap worker who's willing to work for less than the minimum wage, that puts pressure on me to accept lower wages because there's somebody else who will replace me otherwise. And so A lot of these laws that are targeting immigrants, I think, are designed to control a low-wage workforce. I'm writing a story for The Nation right now about something I'm calling Juan Crow. You know, Jim Crow was an expression of the industrial age, right? Jim Crow was rural. Juan Crow is an expression of a different kind of a nation, a different period in U.S. history, a period that's more globalized, right? But still, there are similarities to its cousin, Jim Crow. For example, limiting the physical mobility of slaves and of freed African Americans after emancipation. We have the similar things in, say, taking away driver's licenses. Mm-hmm. From immigrants. You limit. I mean, Plessy versus Ferguson was based on the need, the desires of African and Americans who wanted to be mobile on public transportation. So this, I think we need to look at the driver's licenses issue within this frame. Linguistic and mental mobility, limits on the education. You know, in the information age, education or the lack thereof is concomitant with economic suicide in many cases. Now just look at the prison system and literacy rates. Housing limits and limits on their very existence, as in, for example, the Sensenbrenner immigration bill last year, which criminalized being an immigrant human being. And, you know, the story goes on and on. So this story is not new, but then it has new elements that I'm trying to put together in this Juan Crow thing I'm working on. The other thing that the state needs is establish mechanisms for the political control of non-citizens, but also of citizens, of all of you, of us. Immigration debate is as much about inserting laws into our lives that will control us more. Think the Military Commissions Act, or think the Real ID Act, which will nationalize, will lead to the nationalization of ID cards, not just for immigrants, although they're selling it in the legislature. Mm-hmm. But this is part of my thesis, that immigrants are being used. I mean, when I saw what was happening to South Asians, Arabs, Muslims after 9/11, I thought about what happened to we as Salvadoran extracted peoples during the war, when the whole surveillance apparatus, the whole repressive apparatus of the Reagan administration was applied to us. A lot of these laws, they're kind of being rehashed. You know, but then the good news is a lot of the people that fought those laws in places like the Center for Constitutional Rights also cut their teeth with us. And so there's an adjustment. There's always, as Michael mentioned, let's look at the fact that ICE is the most militarized branch of government besides the Pentagon. Why? Is it because there's a lot of gun-wielding immigrants? No, actually the anti-immigrant people are the ones with the guns. Minutemen, right? But there's no ICE for Minutemen. There's big dinners and fundraisers and, you know, PACs for Minutemen and think tanks that allow them to normalize their rather raw frontier ethos. It's militarized because the state, I think, needs to have more military people out in the civil society when you hollowed out the economy of the country in the ways that have been described and that we don't have time to really go into. But just consider, for example, that Linda Lake, one of Bill Clinton's former pollsters, did a poll on the American Dream. Did anybody see this poll? Said that 18% of people in this country, only 18% believe that they have anything resembling the American Dream. 18%. So in an environment like that, where we're all worried about the death of the dream, even though some of us believe it never existed. If you're the elites, what are you thinking? Geez, I've got to control this. And so you need to have people with guns out and deployed under whatever excuse you can, be they ICE agents, be they police, be they alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. I mean, this is a tried and true part of any good statecraft. If you read Gibbon or if you read Machiavelli, if you read anybody like that, this is what statecraft is about. But we on the left seem to forget that. Most local police forces now are being trained to police in times of terror. Mm-hmm. You know, people like Bill Bratton in Los Angeles, who brought us the terrorization of gangs that's causing all these raids on gangs and the excuses on gangs, these raids that you're seeing on immigrant evil drug gangs. You know, they're learning a lot of this in Israel, training in Israel to police in times of... and so it adds up, again, to increase the number of folks with guns in our midst. And now why? We've already gone into why. I think you know, it's got to do with the outsourcing of jobs, the outsourcing of the American dream, the restructuring of the economy, the obsolescence of workers, the herbicide reflected in, say, Detroit or New Orleans. Herbicide. Mike Davis and other urban theoreticians are now talking about the decimation of entire cities. The elites have gotten so bold that they don't just don't take out your neighborhood like in the Jane Jacobs days. Now we'll take out your whole city if you don't chill out. This is the kind of a state that we're up against. And rather than talk about this, they divert our attention from, say, the declining currency of things like our political system. The political system has been radically cheapened since, say, the election of Bush. The death of the middle class. And the declining currency of whiteness. It's no coincidence that most Minutemen are white. Okay, but the debate doesn't include whiteness in the discussion. And I just wrote something today to somebody about how if Latinos and other immigrants don't bring in the issue of race into the debate, it's like African Americans not being able to bring in the discussion of whiteness that they've done so eloquently, intelligently, and forcefully for centuries. This is the challenge for the immigrant rights movement. Immigrants have long served masters of statecraft to reconfigure and legitimate the state. Let's look at, and Michael made reference to it in around the 1780s, late 1790s. When you had a great global restructuring, when the U.S. was an ascendant power, and you had this battle between what direction capitalism would take, the Federalists wanted to industrialize, go industrial, while Thomas Jefferson wanted to go more agrarian, rural, romantic. You know, the battles between them and the battles in relation of, are you for the French Revolution? Are you against it? Are the ideals of the French Revolution had a profound impact on how immigrants were perceived and they even how immigrants were treated. For example, as there was all this restructuring, there was the Whiskey Rebellion. I think you were making reference to Fry's Rebellion. These were mostly immigrant-led rebellions. If you're the elites, what do you want to do? You insert control, you use them as a way to build yourself up. It's not just your old-fashioned industrial, these ideas that immigrants are being scapegoated. It's a lot more than scapegoating. The immigrants are being used to launch the very apparatus that affects all of us. The internal security program adopted by the Federalists during the administration of John Adams was designed not only to deal with potential dangers from foreign invasion growing up out of the half-war with France, but also to repress domestic political opposition. Immigrants, this was a historian who said this, a historian of this period. So the French Revolution was like the proto-communist, Al-Qaeda-like subversive threat of the 19th century. There were a lot of immigrants involved in that. I won't quote more. And so you had, as a result, the Alien and Sedition Acts. Target immigrants, make it easier to put them in jail. Sound familiar? The creation of the first national security state and bureaucracy. You had the creation of the new army, the Navy, and the Marines. And the Federalist-dominated Congress, Fifth Congress, passed a bill authorizing $454,000 on defense, which at that time was a huge amount. In the second session, it legitimated spending $3,800,000. In the third session, it authorized over $10 million. Exponential growth of the state bureaucracy thanks to the fear of immigrants and their connections to international threats. Sound familiar? We saw the same thing in the Palmer Raids. I was trying to find a parallel to the current situation with immigrants after the 2006 marches. And I went and I looked and I looked and I found the Palmer Raids. Mm-hmm. Crisis, restructuring, joblessness, depression, unemployment. 4 million workers mobilized against the state, basically, against their condition. 1/5 of the manufacturing force, 3,600 strikes. Immigrant leadership. Does this sound familiar? What do the elites do? Home invasions, attack, getting people capturing in their homes, deporting them. Reorganizing the state bureaucracy. J. Edgar Hoover, a lieutenant of Palmer, gave us and brought us the FBI, another massive state policing entity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Roberto. Thank you.
Over the last couple of years on Law and Disorder, we spent a lot of time covering in depth the scope of the surveillance state that is now affecting all of us in the United States and in the world. Today, we're really excited to have with us Maureen Webb, the author of a new book on security. The new book is called Illusions of Security, Global Surveillance and Democracy in the Post-9/11 World. Maureen Webb is a human rights lawyer in Canada, and in this book, she examines how governments worldwide are following the lead of the Bush administration to make us into not just a surveillance country, but a surveillance world. Maureen Webb, down here from Canada, doing the same kind of stuff up there that we're trying to do on Law and Disorder here. A big welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much, Michael.
We have your book, Illusions of Security. I started reading it last night. Good job.
Thank you.
You know, we've been doing the kind of thing that you're doing for almost 3 years here on Law and Disorder. You've taken it a step higher because you not only talk about what's going on in the United States in terms of surveillance, but how they're doing it globally. Tell me, what's your thinking on what's been happening since 9/11?
Well, I think that there's been a lot of initiatives that have been introduced by governments around the world, often through international forums like the G8, International Civil Aviation Organization. The population, even the well-attuned population, like you and I, are very unaware of. And these are initiatives that surveil entire populations. And that's what I talk about in my book, and their effect on democratic societies.
Can you give us a few examples of the technologies being used?
Yes. In the book, I talk about how governments are now biometrically registering populations with biometric identity documents.
What does that mean?
Biometrics is the use of biological traits that human beings have to identify people. So, for instance, fingerprints are the most well-known, but also things like iris scans, digital recordings of our faces, the dimensions of our faces, and biometric technology records those biometric identifiers and stores them either in a database or in a computer chip that can be embedded in an identity
document. Where do they get that from? I mean, where do they get your fingerprints from, your face, your eyes? What?
Well, it's interesting. Since 9/11, they started biometrically registering marginal populations. So, for example, the National Entry-Exit Security Registration Program, right after 9/11, the government systematically registered all males between the ages of 16 and 45.
Is this your government in Canada or ours here in the States?
That's yours in the States.
How about yours?
Is that everybody who comes in and out of the United States?
All visitors or people traveling to or through the United States from Muslim countries. And their fingerprints were taken.
Oh, it's from Muslim countries in particular.
Exactly. So there was a sort of an ethnic profiling that was done. Then that registration was expanded to all visitors through the U.S. visit program. And then it was expanded even more widely to citizens through biometric passports, which my government and yours agreed to in the G8 forums.
What's a biometrics passport?
Well, it's a biometric. My country is using digital face recognition, but countries in the EU are using fingerprints.
So wait, your face is now in your passport somehow?
That's right.
Not just as a picture, but in some other measurement.
As a digital photograph.
Does that mean there is a radio frequency identification chip in each passport?
Yes. The governments are also putting RFID chips into passports.
Which governments?
In the ICAO, that's the International Civil Aviation Organization, specifications, they call for RFID chips to be inserted so that the information in the passport can be read at a distance.
And which governments are going to be doing this?
Many governments around the world. Yours, mine, governments in Europe, governments in Asia. And in the United States, it was revealed that this could be very dangerous for Americans because anybody with an RFID reader in a crowd could pick out Americans for targeting. Also, identity thieves or terrorists could read the information and copy it so that they could be identity fraud. And the government, its solution was to put a foil, a metal foil, into the passport so that it couldn't be read surreptitiously. But then you have to wonder, why do they have them in the first place? If you have to open them up and read them closely, what's the difference between having, the RFID and an ordinary contact a chip.
Well, you know, where we started the conversation was you're saying they were getting biometric information on marginal populations and then on passports.
Yeah.
So I guess the next question is, why do they need that? It seems less to me that it's about the passport than about getting that information to some massive database. Is that right?
Right. You know, once you have a biometric identity document, and I didn't finish, after they introduced biometric passports, the UK, Canada, and the US, all common law countries in which we have always resisted the imposition of a national identity card. The governments floated the idea of identity cards. It was shot down very quickly in each country by the democratic houses of government. But after the biometric passport was imposed, the idea was resurrected again. And in the UK and the US, the legislation was rammed through the Houses of Government. In the U.S., you have a de facto identity card with the standardization of your driver's licenses and the linkage of the state information in the driver's license. This is an identity card that you have to carry around all the time.
Let me ask you about the driver's license. They haven't done that yet. I mean, my driver's license is still an old New York City or state driver's license. But is it going to be required that every state has these standardized driver's license with this information?
That's right. So when you renew your driver's license, over time the whole population will have a standardized card with databases that are linked. In the U.S., Congress voted the Real ID Act down in 2004, and in 2005 the government attached it to a must-pass bill raising funds for the troops in Iraq, and it was rammed through.
Maureen, give us an idea of some of the other stuff that they're doing, not only in the United States, but abroad.
Yeah. Well, you know, once governments have a biometric identity document for everybody in their population and in foreign populations, the idea is that they have a sort of gold standard for identifying people so that they know who they're dealing with. But of course, biometrics is a highly flawed technology. It has high error rates, even for the best biometrics. And so, you know, millions of people will still be vulnerable to mistaken identity. Once they have that identifier for everybody is registered, they can start linking information so that since 9/11, they're starting to gather from many, many sources of information about people, information that they've never had access to before. So, for example, in the U.S., many people would be surprised to know that the government buys personal information on American citizens from commercial data aggregators like DoubleClick and ChoicePoint. DoubleClick boasts that it has information on 90 million households in the U.S. They're buying information on foreign citizens through hook or by crook. They managed to obtain, for example, the entire voter registry of Mexico. They are asking companies to give them information, and companies are falling over themselves to hand over the information.
Where does the information all go?
Well, it goes into various databases, and, you know, many databases are converging. So, for example, in my country, we recently had a linkage of all Justice Department-related and immigration-related databases. It's called the Justice sort of supercomputer. There's greater access for government and law enforcement to be able to access databases. So they don't necessarily have to be physically linked as long as they're accessible.
And would that be medical and governmental and consumer?
Yes, it's a mixture of public and private sector databases. So, for example, the U.S. Visit Program links about 20 federal databases plus commercial databases. The CAPS-2 program, which was the computer-assisted passenger pre-screening system, it was supposed to link public databases with an unlimited number of commercial databases. Programs like Total Information Awareness, which was killed by Congress, but insiders say that it, you know, it's just a shell game. The different areas of it have pushed off into other programs. And like ADVISE, which is another new one, they aim to, quote, mine the transaction space, unquote. Their aim is to sort of just suck up all the information that's available about people in electronic form. On their website, TIA talked about medical records, employment records, housing records, driver's records, licensing records.
What's TIA?
It was run out of DARPA.
But what does the initial stand for?
Total Information Awareness.
And Americans found that just a bit too creepy. Right. So they changed it to Terrorist Information Awareness.
Right. We're talking with Maureen Webb. She's the author of Illusions of Security. It's a wonderful book on the global surveillance and democracy in the post-9/11 world. And of course, that has an interesting name, Illusions of Security. You've been talking about all these systems of getting information, biometrics, from passports to driver's license to everything else, but you somehow don't think that's making us more secure. Is that right?
That's right. These new initiatives don't make us more secure. They create only the illusions of
security. And why is that?
Because they don't work. The premise is flawed. The premise is that if you watch everybody all the time, you'll be more secure. That's the logic of police states. That's the logic of the Stasi. The information that they use is often incorrect, incomplete, uncontextualized, and there's no mechanisms for individuals to see that information or to correct it. And the technology is flawed. As I said, biometrics have high rates of error. And the data mining technology that we haven't spoken about yet, which is the high-tech way of sifting through these oceans of information to sort populations, not to look for known terrorists or people who are suspected of terrorism on reasonable grounds, but to predict who among us might be a terrorist. I mean, how Kafkaesque is that? Right. This is very highly flawed technology, too, and it's being used in Europe and the United States. In Canada, we have a center called the National Risk Assessment Center, which is essentially a data mining program. It assigns risk scores to individuals. This is highly flawed technology, too, because, of course, it's not interested in accuracy. What it's trying to do is to preempt and predict.
Maureen, can you give us an example or two of the kind of risk factors that these computers are set up to look for?
Well, they're secret, so we don't know for sure. For example, in Germany, they have a program called it's a trawling program. And it was set up to run the profile of the people from the Hamburg cell of Al-Qaeda against whole populations. So, but you can imagine, these are very wide markers of so-called terrorist activity. So they were looking for young guys from Muslim countries who were students, and so they captured thousands of students in that dragnet. I met a young guy in Chicago a couple of weeks ago, and he said that he and his dad had been stopped for extra airport screening because they had a one-way ticket to Florida.
Well, when you mentioned the German case, it's interesting because the Center for Constitutional Rights initially represented Kurnaz, who was taken to Guantanamo, and he was German, and it was a mistake, but he was picked up in one of these kinds of associations through this kind of information that he knew someone who knew someone from the Hamburg cell, supposedly, and they claimed he knew a suicide bomber, but of course the suicide bomber never was a suicide bomber, it was somebody else. So there's an example to me of one of the mistakes. One of the other ones you mentioned in your book is another both center case as well as a case that was obviously very prominent in Canada, is Maher Arar.
Yes.
How does that case fit into what you're saying about illusions of security and mistakes?
Yeah. Well, I talk about high-tech and low-tech risk assessment. The high-tech risk assessment is the data mining technology I've been talking about. Low-tech risk assessment is a world in which bureaucrats have high incentives to err on the side of caution. They're given mandates of preemption, of prevention. No one wants to be the person that fails to flag a terrorist. And I talk about all kinds of things like indefinite detention, the sweeps that happened after 9/11 that swept up hundreds of immigrants in the United States, torture.
These are all our cases.
Yeah, exactly. This is the low tech area of risk assessment. And the case of Maher Arar shows the consequences, the potential consequences of a negative risk assessment.
Let me just remind our listeners who that is. Maher Arar was the Canadian citizen who was taken off a plane at Kennedy. He was transiting from Tunisia back to Canada. He was taken off and sent by the United States government to Syria, where he was tortured underground cell for 10 months or so. He's finally out, and the Canadians just, in a major settlement, gave him $9 million U.S. for their part in the plot. The U.S., of course, is still keeping him out of the country. But
that's right.
Yeah. His crime was talking to somebody about buying a computer printer, I think.
That's right. He had lunch with somebody.
Yeah.
is there anything else you want to say about
Maher Arar? I want to say a couple of things. There's several points in which that case had aspects of this global surveillance infrastructure that I'm talking about. The investigations the AO Canada investigation in Toronto and Ottawa, which picked him up along with some other Canadians. It was an integrated national security enforcement team where Mounties worked with the FBI and we think the CIA with absolutely no sovereign checks and balances, no controls over how information was shared. And this is one of the examples I talk about of how information is converging and being shared with little or no control by countries after 9/11. And it also shows how indiscriminately they're interpreting information and their indiscriminate actions when they interpret information. So, for example, the Mounties, they had characterized Mayor Arar as a person of interest. He wasn't a target. He wasn't, you know, they had nothing that suggested that he was involved in terrorist activity at all. But because he knew a target, he had lunch with the target, he became a person of interest. But at the same time, they were giving mixed messages to the FBI and the CIA. They were saying that he and his wife were Muslim fanatics and that he had been in Washington on 9/11, which was completely false. Right. The Americans picked him up when they were alerted by advanced passenger information, which is another part of the global surveillance infrastructure, where state agencies get information on passengers.
They send them in advance. Like if I get on a plane in Tunisia, they'll send it to the U.S.
That's right. And there's advanced passenger information, which is basically the manifest for the who's on the plane. And there's also passenger name record information, which includes up to 65 fields of information. So they picked him up with this. And then they rendered him to torture in Syria. So it shows the globalized aspect of the infrastructure and the indiscriminate interpretations of information.
I just wanted to remind Law and Disorder listeners, I'm here with Heidi Boghossian and Michael Ratner. I'm Michael Smith. We're speaking with the author of the just-released book, Maureen Webb has written Illusions of Security, Global Surveillance and Democracy in the Post-9/11 World. It's a dynamite book. We urge all of you to get it. Maureen, I wanted to ask you, what was it that led you to write this book?
Well, I came to this subject matter really as a mother and a lawyer. we got a bad name these days, and we deserve it. I think lawyers have a particular responsibility because our profession is going to have a lot to answer for at the end of this era. I came to New York the week that to take up a fellowship at Columbia University the week that 9/11 happened. And at the time, my son was 5 months old. I just finished breastfeeding him, and my daughter was three. And you know, we were here when the anthrax attacks happened, and I was terrified. The woman that died was in our postal district. But at the same time, as a lawyer, listening to the debate unfold in political and academic circles, I was, you know, I wanted governments to catch the terrorists as much as anybody, but I was deeply troubled by the direction that that policy was going, aided by lawyers who were coming up with ideas, you know, these really evil doctrines of enemy combatant, preemptive war. As a lawyer, I guess I just became absorbed in these issues. When I went back to to Canada, I got involved in the Campaign for Justice for Mayor Arar, and I'm co-chair of a pan-Canadian civil society organization called the International Civil Liberties Monitoring Group. And you know, that's a terrific, terrific group. In 2004, they started to understand that what was happening in our country and in the United States was not sui generis. That there seemed to be patterns around the world. So they brought the American Civil Liberties Union, State Watch from Europe, Focus on the Global South from Asia. So these major NGOs working on these issues. I think we invited the CCR too. I think they had Steve Watt from the CCR.
Oh, Steve was at CCR then. That's right.
And
I remember, you know, when he went to the meeting.
Yes, yeah. And we sat around the table for 2 days and talked about what was happening in our countries and identified patterns. Talked about how we might collaborate, and we understood that a lot of this stuff was happening in international forums. And so what was necessary to stop this stuff was an international civil society effort. We established a campaign called the International Campaign Against Mass Surveillance, and this book grew out of all of those
nice.
Efforts.
Good story.
What can our listeners do to advance knowledge about this and hopefully affect some kind of change?
Well, I think, you know, there's organizations in the United States like the ACLU, CCR, the privacy organizations, EPIC, for example, that are putting out a lot of information on these things. And so, you know, join those organizations, look at their websites, inform yourself. The message I want to give to people is we're not powerless to stop this as citizens. We need to send clear messages to our members of government to tell them that we don't want them to go down this path, that we've got to fight for our own democracies. We're not powerless to stop it.
Maureen Webb, the author of Illusions of Security, Global Surveillance and Democracy in the Post-9/11 World. We haven't had any terrible terrorist attack since 9/11 here in New York City. The people that have set up this global surveillance apparatus say, see, we've been successful. I think that's kind of analogous to saying that I keep a clove of garlic in my refrigerator and therefore I don't have any elephants in the bathroom. But in any case, it's hard to refute that. I think there's a different argument, and I think it's the argument of why anonymity is essential to a democracy. And I wanted to ask you what your thoughts are on that.
Well, to begin with, you know, there was a widely held belief after 9/11 that American security agencies should have known about the plots and prevented them. But in fact, the 9/11 Commission and the congressional inquiries into the events found that the CIA and the FBI, the traditional methods of law enforcement and security intelligence, you know, where you're looking for specific risks in specific circles and you're working out from there on leads instead of looking at everybody all the time, the traditional methods yielded substantial information. They knew that there were Muslim fanatics that were planning an attack on U.S. soil, that were talking about using airplanes. They were tracking two of the 9/11 hijackers at the time, and the congressional inquiry found that the failure of the security establishment in the United States was that they couldn't see the bigger picture. And if they couldn't see the forest for the trees when they had specific information, how much better will they do with this ocean of information that they're collecting on, you know, millions of innocent people? When you look at each of these programs, you know, the people that developed biometrics say that it's a highly flawed technology. The FBI agents who received the flood of tips from the National Security Agency Domestic Spy Program said that they didn't find anything out that they didn't already know through traditional means, and that it was drowning them in tips that were diverting agents from more productive counterterrorism efforts. So if you look at each of these things, they haven't caught one terrorist with these initiatives.
Yeah, Michael Ratner's fond of saying it's just like in 1984, where you got the bad guy Goldstein out there, and they went out of their way not to catch him. You know, they don't want to catch Osama because they need that specter of evilness to justify what they're doing.
Yeah.
But let me get back to one point you made before about how they didn't see the big picture. Are you talking about what Susan Sontag, who was like the only one who tried to talk about the big picture in this country and who was creamed for her efforts, the big picture being simply this, that the role that the United States plays in the oppression of people in the Middle East is horrific. And we have to have a discussion about that, a discussion about the Palestinians, discussion about the lack of democracy in Saudi Arabia and so on. Is that what you mean?
Yes. Well, I talk about the neoconservative plans that were developing in think tanks a decade before 9/11 happened, and how they were really preaching a doctrine of preemption. They were already talking about preemptive war back then, using the military muscle of the United States to sort of discipline the world and enforce its interests around the world. The Middle East has always been a highly strategic area for the U.S., and until there's peace in the Middle East, and it has to be a just peace, there will never be, real security. I was at a talk that Howard Zinn gave last night at the Cooper Union, and he talked about how the history of the United States, how it has engaged in imperialistic wars around the world in just about, you know, every decade or so. The United States has to, if it's going to change its destiny. It has to look at its militarism. It has to look at its imperial actions. And I talk about in the book, and this might be presumptuous as a Canadian, but, you know, we live very close to you. We're very much affected by
We're
you, so maybe that
together.
Gives me a right. is that, you know, Americans, they have this almost mythology about the goodness of the United States, that the United States only acts for good, and that the United States is the spreader of democracy around the world. I say that that might be the tragic flaw of Americans, because it leads them to believe their leaders when they take them into unnecessary wars and create greater insecurity. This whole war on terrorism has exacerbated world insecurity, not just for your country, but for all countries. And it's a completely spurious adventure, because terrorism is by no means the major threat facing mankind at this time. If you look at State Department figures, which are said to be inflated over a sort of a 10-year period up to 2004, the number of deaths around the world caused by terrorist acts, this is globally, is about 700. Compare that to Katrina. Compare that to the people that are dying from the lack of health care, that are dying in Iraq. So, yes, it might be presumptuous of me to say that, but Americans need to hear it, because I think there's a large number of people in America that feel that way, and there's certainly a large number of people around the world that feel that way.
Maureen, this has been a true pleasure. We wish you the best of luck with your new book. It's Illusions of Security, Global Surveillance and Democracy in the Post-9/11 World. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Maureen.
Maureen, it looks great.
It's fabulous.
Yeah,
really.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.